Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining this presentation of SES's Q1 2018 results. In a moment, Steve Collar, President and CEO, and Andrew Brown, Group CFO, will present the main highlights of the quarter. They are joined this morning by Ferdinand Kaiser and J.P. Hemingway, the CEOs of SES Video and SES Networks, who will also say a few words. After the presentation, there will be time to take questions. The results documents are available on the investors section of the ses.com website if you don't already have them, and as usual, please note the disclaimer at the back. With that, I'd like to hand over to Steve.
Thank you, Richard, and morning, everyone. Thanks for joining our Q1 call. This is my first set of results and first call as CEO, officially 3 weeks in, so very much looking forward to spending more time with all you guys going forward. It's a bit of a morning of firsts. Andrew Brown is alongside me. It's his first official call also as CFO. Very excited to be working with Andrew again. While Andrew is not new to many of you, someone who almost certainly is J.P. Hemingway, who's also here on his first call, having taken up the reins at SES Networks, and he's obviously here to provide additional color on the networks business. To complete the intros, Ferd Kaiser is also here, and you'll be relieved to hear it is not his first call. With that, on with the results, and as I've said previously, our focus is very much on execution in 2018 and on performing as a business and delivering on our expectations. I'm pleased to say that, you know, in this quarter, as a first step, we've done that. We've delivered a solid quarter with revenues and EBITDA very much in line with our expectations. We're starting to see the anticipated growth coming through in networks, which is up 8.5% on an underlying basis, which is obviously very good news. We've updated our video fundamentals analysis, and as you see, a little later in the presentation, our video business continues to be characterized as large, resilient, growing in terms of channels and households, and extremely profitable, serving the best customers at the best video neighborhoods. In both video and networks, we've signed a number of important contracts in the quarter that Ferd and J.P. will elaborate on, with some long-term renewals at our core video neighborhoods that we've secured at like-for-like pricing, as well as important customer commitments across the three networks verticals. Strong execution in the quarter operationally also, with three successful launches, something that I think we can be very satisfied with and very proud of. With one of those, SES-16 GovSat already in operation, and SES-14 coming later in the year with four new O3b satellites to bring to market at the end of Q2. We've got some important new assets that are gonna underpin our ongoing development. Sort of to emphasize the importance of that, it's really good to have SES-15 online and serving customers, and that was the case early in Q1. SES-15's already become the prime satellite and prime neighborhood to serve North American airlines and aero service providers. It's a market that's also growing very quickly, which J.P. will also touch on. Sort of last on this slide, it's our intention to fully scrub the numbers across the business, as you'd expect with Andrew and I sort of coming in, and we're kicking off that process now. Given our Q1 numbers, our outlook remains unchanged, and we'll provide an update on short and medium-term expectations on our call with the H1 results. With that overview, turning on to slide 2, I'm gonna go fairly quickly through the next set of slides. Leaving aside the impact of foreign exchange and periodic revenue that we saw in Q1 2017, associated primarily with the sale of transponders to Global Eagle, our underlying revenue was stable year-on-year. Revenue of 477.6 million was in line with our expectations, as was EBITDA at 304.4 million. Our margin, excluding a partial restructuring provision taken in the quarter, was 64.8%. Net profit of 98.2 million, and backlog, which has been stable, including, well, at constant foreign exchange at 7.2 billion, contracted and secured across the business. Some good, solid backlog numbers also underpinning the business. On slide 3, we drill a little bit further into video, which generated 324 million in revenue in Q1. Underlying revenue was down 3.6%, but if you strip out the effect of the IFRS accounting changes, and The ongoing but increasingly marginal impact from some satellite health issues that we had in 2017, the number is less than 1% in terms of a reduction from last year, or $3 million in revenue year on year. So, and both of the impacts of the IFRS and the satellite health issues will wash out over the course of this year. As I mentioned, we've updated our annual global review of technical reach, and that shows that we have a massive 351 million households that rely on SES video satellites and services to receive their TV viewing, and that we distribute almost 7,800 TV channels across our system. And from my perspective, there's no other distribution platform that comes close to replicating the scale with the same performance, reliability, and economics. And our customers are also increasing their use of high-definition and ultra-high-definition channels across our system. Overall, strong fundamentals in our core business. And I'm going to hand over to Ferd, who's going to speak to some of the deals that we've signed over the course of the first quarter.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. And as mentioned already, the video team has continued to secure important renewals and new business. And I would like to share some examples which are outlined on slide 4. First, we secured an important capacity extension with Viacom in Europe of 19.2 for Germany and Austria and on 28.2 for the UK. Second, and also using 19.2 in Europe, we facilitated Canal Plus, who have launched their first UHD channel for satellite subscribers. With this UHD channel, Canal is able to deliver premium sports, soccer games from the French Premier League and Formula One, movies and original series in UHD to potentially 100% of the households in France via satellite. So in order to receive this UHD channel in France, Canal Plus subscribers need either a fiber connection or satellite reception, and as in France, only between 20 and 30% of all the households can be connected to fiber, Canal Plus decided to proactively push and promote satellite as a preferred distribution infrastructure, as it is the only one offering what they call a quality guarantee. In the international market, Kibisat wanted to expand their DTH offering for their subscribers who live on the Caribbean islands, where the options were quite limited. We have signed a long-term agreement where Kibisat will use capacity on SES 10 to broadcast 130 TV channels, including 90 channels in HD. Here, we work with the customer on the various steps of the rollout of this new offer. Lastly, MX1 continues to expand its portfolio of services, adding new deals such as the one with the news agency AFP. AFP is now relying on MX1 for an end-to-end service consisting in the distribution of all their broadcast feeds in IP to their customers all over the world. This allowed AFP to remove a significant operational bottleneck by enabling its customers to access content more easily via a cloud-based service platform. And with that, I hand back to Steve.
Thanks, Ferd. I won't dwell too long on slides 5 and 6. They simply break down the distribution and service business picture in a bit more detail for you. So the main takeaways are on slide 5, that overall our video distribution business is stable. We saw a reduction in volume in North America, which explains much of the decline in the underlying revenue year on year. This was anticipated and expected. The broadcasters were reducing the number of channels simultaneously broadcast in standard definition and high definition, and that reflects the increasingly high penetration of HD in North America. We also saw a couple of what I would describe as entrepreneurial business models in the emerging markets failed to get the traction that we had expected during 2017, and that's dragged down a little bit our expected growth in the international markets. That said, we see some good and healthy prospects for SES 9 and SES 10, and our priority is very much to convert these leads into contracts in the coming months. Pleasingly, our core European business was stable, our customers continue to make 10-year commitments, and as we said last month, we've limited renewals at our core neighbourhoods over the course of the next 12 months. Slide 6, our video service business shows some nice underlying growth for the quarter when we back out the IFRS accounting change. This growth was driven primarily by HD Plus, where we benefited from a higher annual fee, and that was implemented at the start of Q2 last year. Given that this growth comes largely from that sort of price adjustment, we're pretty cautious about not reading too much into that growth from an ongoing perspective. But also encouragingly, given that we had MX1 being something of a drag on the revenues for our service business in 2017 as we were cleaning up some legacy low-margin resale business, MX1's now started very much to return to stability, which is encouraging. So, slide 7, turning to SES Networks, and SES Networks has had a good quarter, obviously the impact of the new CEO. The business delivered $153 million in revenue, up 8.5% on an underlying basis, as I've mentioned. We have an unfavorable comp this year, year-on-year, as we sold a large number of transponders to Global Eagle in 2017, and that generated an unusually high level of periodic revenue in Q1 2017. But taking that out, and otherwise, we see really strong underlying growth, primarily driven by aero and government, but actually some good positive momentum, I would say, across the networks business. We also had 3 successful launches, as I mentioned, and they will primarily benefit the SES Networks business. Much of that will come later in the year as we bring that capability to service. But we certainly see the impact of having new differentiated capacity in orbit with the impact that SES 15 has had on our Q1 numbers, showing the value of really bringing that differentiated capability to market. We've also had a strong quarter in terms of sales of the networks business, and I'll both introduce to you and hand over to JP, who's going to share a few words about some of the important customers that we've signed in the period. JP.
Thank you, Steve, and obviously delighted to be here as my first time as the CEO of SES Networks, also 3 weeks in, like Steve and Andrew. So I'll touch on just some of the examples here across our segments, but they do underpin the strong performance that Steve outlined. If we take a look at MuSpace, which is in our fixed data business, we're really aligning with a strong push from the Thailand government and regulators to increase broadband penetration from low double digits up to 95%. So it's a very strong push in that market to try and address nearly 60 million people that don't have good access, particularly in the rural areas. So in partnership with our new partner, MuSpace, working with Hughes, offering a fully managed service to drive to nearly 1,800 new sites, delivering both 3G and Wi-Fi coverage to those rural areas. So we're very excited about that new prospect. Switching from fixed data into government, great progress in the government sector, both with our GEO platforms and particularly with our O3b MEO platforms, both in US government, but also in the international markets, both for defense and also for the humanitarian applications. With the US government, we're very pleased to close this latest deal with AFRICOM. That is a full O3b beam, which takes the number of sites we have with the US government to in excess of 20 on the MEO sites, which really underlies the performance and the absolute change to those missions that MEO delivers to those government applications. Switching to the mobility side, we're both in aero and maritime. We're very, very pleased to have brought SES 15 into service earlier than expected. And that's really allowed Gogo, our partner, to add substantial numbers of aircraft to that. They managed to deliver in excess of 200 aircraft in the first operational month, and we know that number has more than doubled since then. So it shows us a great platform, continued growth in the North American markets for aero. And last but not least, in the maritime segment, we continue to make great strides, really disrupting what you should expect from maritime connectivity into the cruise market. We now have 4 named cruise customers in this market, and the one example we have here is with the Medallion Net with Carnival. And we really are breaking new ground. We've now demonstrated a world record to deliver more than 2.5 gigabits to a single moving platform, which is the first time that's ever been done, and really challenges the definition that you can't expect home broadband or hotel-like broadband services onboard a moving platform like a ship. So it's really driving the innovation. This is being noticed by the rest of the cruise market, and we anticipate closing more deals in the coming quarters.
Very good. Thanks, JP. So then the next 3 slides, as you know, we kind of break down our networks business into fixed data, mobility, and government. And the next 3 slides give you a bit more detail on those 3 verticals. So slide 9, the networks fixed data vertical. Underlying fixed data was down 6% year on year. About half of that was due to the loss of AMC9 that we suffered in the middle of last year. And I would say, in general terms, market conditions in fixed data for undifferentiated capacity remain challenging, and we do, without question, have some exposure there. But we're also capturing demand principally with our O3B fleet, our MEO fleet. We're seeing, for example, a full quarter of revenue coming from the Atexa business that we signed and implemented at the back end of last year, and a number of other networks that we're delivering across Africa, the majority of which now are hybrid between our MEO fleet and our GEO fleet. We've actually become quite constrained in Africa and the Middle East on O3B. So bringing the next four satellites into service late in Q2 will certainly help us during the back end of the year in our fixed data business. Slide 10 shows our trajectory in mobility. And again, if you back out the transponder sale that we made to Global Eagle last year, we're up more than 30% year on year, which is hugely encouraging. A lot of that growth is obviously in aero, and much of it is on SES 15. But we're also making good progress in the cruise market, as JP talked about. And that continues to be strong for us and continues to be a good growth driver. And I'd expect and anticipate for us to have some good news to share with you next quarter on services that we are providing to major cruise lines across the fleet. And lastly, even energy is coming back. It's been a bit the ugly stepchild of the mobility industry for a little while, but we've seen some really encouraging signs and some good activity, particularly in Africa and Asia, and that augurs well, I would say, for the future. And then on slide 11, government, and again, I'm really encouraged by the performance of our government business in Q1. This sort of information aggregates our US government business along with the services and solutions that we provide to governments and institutions around the world. The US government has continued its adoption of O3B, as JP's described, and having 20 sites operational is really a step change from where it was this time last year. And in global government, our support for African peacekeeping operations has been extended and has grown, and that is something that we are very proud of as an organization. So, in summary, a solid quarter, positive signs in the market, but a lot of work to do. And as I said, we're focused on execution, on delivering exceptional service to our customers and growing the business. And with that, I will hand over to Andrew.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I am delighted also to be back at SES as the new CFO. I'm really looking forward to continuing working relationship with Steve, who we've worked with now for about 20 years, and the team, Ferd and JP, and the rest of the finance colleagues across the company. And I think the opening thing I would like to say from the CFO perspective is going forward, complete focus on execution, transparency, and communication as we grow the company. So turning to page 13, the financial overview. As Steve has already said, the Q1 numbers are fully in line with the company's expectations. Revenue was $477.6 million in the quarter, with the underlying results showing stable development compared with Q1 of last year. In fact, up $10.9 million, and we'll see that on page 15. On a reported basis, revenue was 11.7% lower and 4.9% lower at constant FX, and also resulting from the unusually high periodic and other revenue that had been shown in Q1 of last year. The impact of adopting IFRS 15 added a non-cash reduction of $8.2 million. EBITDA of $304.4 million represented an EBITDA margin of 63.7%, including the $5 million restructuring provision, and excluding this, the margin would have been 64.8%. Overall, EBITDA was 14.9% lower as reported and down 8.7% at constant FX and following from the revenue development. Normal operating expenses of $168 million were flat at constant FX as compared to quarter one in 2017. Looking at operating profit, the change in FX and lower EBITDA also led to a reduction in operating profit to €139 million in Q1. This represented an operating margin of 29%, which was compared to 34.5% last year. And CapEx, the outlook is unchanged compared with what I think was shared at the full year results in February. Turning over to page 14, net debt to EBITDA, the group's net debt to EBITDA ratio was 3.41 times compared with 3.27 times at the end of 2017. This essentially is due to the lower 12-month rolling EBITDA, which, as you'll see, was mainly caused by the FX and periodic and other revenue. Also in Q1, there was proportionally higher level of CapEx and interest payments, approximately 60% for the full year when comparing to the coming quarters. Looking forward, we have the dividend payment in Q2, which we've just made, and offset by lower relative CapEx and interest during the year, and increased flows emanate from launches and underlying business as we start to see the growth coming through as we go through the year. And so we fully expect the leverage to be below 3.3 times by the end of 2018. Proactively, a euro 500 million bond in terms of liquidity management, we've successfully raised 8 years and a coupon rate of 1.625%, and I believe that's the lowest rate the company has ever achieved. Outlook, as Steve has already said, the company outlook is unchanged. As you would expect, we are in the process of reviewing the plans, the drivers and assumptions, and any dates, any updates emanating from that will be shared with the half-year results. And as I say, going forward, execution, transparency, communications. So looking then at page 15, briefly looking at revenues in more detail. At constant FX, the higher level of periodic and other revenues in Q1 of 24.6 million was the principal driver for the 4.9% reduction on a comparative basis. However, underlying revenue is stable and growth of 10.9 million offset by the impact of the IFRS 50 change in satellite health in total of 10.9 million. Turning to EBITDA, page 16, we see EBITDA was essentially 8.7% lower at constant FX, there again reflecting the periodic and other revenues of 24.6 million. Normalized operating expenses were flat year on year, and we mentioned the restructuring provision of 5 million. So Q2, we expect to book an additional provision of 5.7 million in respect to that, getting back to the previously guided range of 10 to 12 million. And the margin was 63.7%. Turning to page slide 17, shows you the key elements of the income statement. The net profit of euro 98 million included a positive tax contribution that resulted from the recognition of a deferred tax asset related to bringing in the service of GovSat 1, which is owned by the Lux government, and the 50-50 partnership with SES. And approximately 28 million was the total gross amount of that, and the 50% is showing in non-controlling interests. Normalized tax rate was 21.9% in the quarter. Turning to page 18 on CapEx, the CapEx outlook, which is already mentioned, is unchanged from what was disclosed in February at the time of the full year results. Leverage that I touched upon at my opening remarks on page 19. As mentioned, net debt of 3.41 times at the end of March, slightly higher than what it was 3 months ago, and that reflects the impact of the 12-month rolling EBITDA and also the higher proportion relatively of the CapEx and interest payments during the quarter. And I refer to the dividend in Q2, which will be offset by those lower CapEx and interest payments and indeed the business as we grow going forward, and leverage will be below 3.3 times at the end of the year. And then lastly, on financial outlook, as Steve has mentioned and as I referred to, you know, we are underway looking at reviewing the plans, drivers, assumptions, and any updates that may be coming from this exercise will of course be communicated with the Q2 results. With that, I think, Richard, I would hand over.
Thanks, Andrew. Operator, I think we are now ready for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. We will now take our first question from Paul Sidney of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for taking my questions. I've got three quick questions, please. Firstly, on video, your existing guidance assumes that video returns to growth by 2020. I know, obviously, it's under review, but conceptually, do you still stick with the view that video can return to growth at some point over the next 2 or 3 years? Secondly, just a quick one on the C-band proposal in the US. I was just wondering if we could get Steve's view on the potential opportunity for SES there. Clearly, Intelsat has been, you know, talking relatively positively about the opportunity for them financially. Just wanting to get your view. And then just lastly, just sort of big picture. Obviously, the industry's gone through a very difficult 2 years. It's probably a bit of an understatement. But again, just be keen to get Steve's view on whether you think we're over the worst. If you read your statement, it reads a lot more positively than previous statements you've had. A lot of discussion on the call about contracts that you've won. So it just seems to me as though things within SES seem a bit more upbeat. Thank you.
Okay, great, Paul. Thanks very much. Look, I'll take all of those, I think. So the first on video, no change, essentially. As we said, we're going to go and do a full scrub. Don't think that, as I said, 3 weeks in is necessarily the time to get into what we think about, video in 2020. So no change to the position there. On C-band, look, I think our emphasis is a little different from Intelsat's for reasons that you can probably surmise. Our focus is really on making sure that, the process and the work that we're doing at the moment completely protects what we consider to be an incredibly important neighborhood and sort of series of neighborhoods in North America. It is, as I think I've said before when I've been asked about this, I think it is the first time where you do have the possibility for a market-based solution which is controlled and where the interests of the current customers can be completely defended. And that's really why I'm optimistic and encouraged about the discussions that are ongoing at the moment. It's really not, we're not really focused at all on, any potential financial opportunity. And in fact, protecting that customer base is going to require a very significant amount of investment. And that's really where our focus is and what we're working through right now. And then big picture, sort of, are we over the worst? Look, I'd say we've seen more disruption, and you guys know this better than most, we've seen more disruption in this industry over the course of the last 2 or 3 years than at any time probably in its past. I think that is net a good thing long term, because we're moving to an environment where satellite is more core within telco networks in particular, within sort of fixed data networks. But obviously it's been fairly painful in the process of getting there. I think we'll continue to see that disruption. And again, I don't necessarily think that that's bad. So I wouldn't necessarily say we're over the worst, but I would certainly say that we're encouraged by the progress we're making. We've been encouraged for a while, to be honest. The challenge is making sure that kind of comes through in the numbers. And when I say we've been encouraged for a while, I think we've seen some good traction with the differentiated capacity that we've had with O3b, with the sort of the hybrid services that we're offering. I would say no sort of more or less encouraged, wouldn't characterize it as over the worst. Disruption will continue, and the businesses that sort of will be successful are the ones that both cope best with that disruption and to some extent drive it, which I think has been our position up till now.
That's great. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Paul.
We'll now take our next question from Sarah Simon of Berenberg. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. I've got three questions as well. First one would be on Ultra HD. We saw the news that RTL is launching a free-to-air channel in Germany on that, and that, I think, is the first mainstream free-to-air in Europe. Just wondering if you're seeing more signs of that, and also what's the state of play in terms of the availability of set-top boxes, because I know that's been an issue in terms of really moving Ultra HD along, and particularly in the US. Second one was on the minority interest. Is there something funny in that charge? Because if you own half of SES 16, that kind of implies it's made around about 30 million euros in the quarter. Even at full run rate, you think that's probably what it would make in a year. So I'm just wondering what's going on there. And the final one was just in terms of government, obviously a very strong result. But I'm just interested in what you think is going on in terms of, let's say, the underlying picture in government as it would relate to people, say, who aren't offering MEO. Thanks.
Great. Bird, if you'll take the...
Yeah.
On Ultra HD in Germany by RTL. So indeed, Sarah's RTL in Germany is the first commercial free TV operator opting for UHD and starting at the end of this month. So here it is a very important first one, but we know that other free TV operators in Europe have also plans to launch Ultra HD before the end of this year. Regarding the set-top boxes, yes, the number of set-top boxes as such are somewhat limited in the market at the current stage, but at, in the future and in the near future, it's not so much about set-top boxes anymore, because the new Ultra HD TV sets are equipped with an Ultra HD tuner, and there what you need then is just a TV set and the common interface module with, in the case of Germany, of RTL, because this is handled via HD Plus and HD Plus smart card.
So you do, but you still need a set top if you're a you know, a cable subscriber in the US or a satellite customer, you're going to still need a set top box.
Yes, and if you are a cable subscriber in the US, you do. But if you are a satellite subscriber of HD Plus in Germany, you do not necessarily need a set-top box. You can handle it via the CI module and the smart card, which you insert in your Ultra HD TV set.
Okay. So it's pay that's being held up rather than free, essentially.
Yeah, so the Ultra HD channel, as the HD channels in Germany by RTL and the other commercial operators, are encrypted and are distributed via HD Plus. So you need an HD Plus, either Ultra HD set-top box or a smart card going into the CI module in the TV set.
Okay.
And who's going to take the question on minority interest?
And minority interest, Sarah, that the joint venture, and it's a 50-50, but we consolidate totally all of the financial impact of that. And with the launch of the satellite and coming into operations, there was a deferred tax asset that had been carried of approximately 27 to 28 million. And so because of that, then that was a one-time allocation, and hence we take the full credit with 50% approximately showing under the minority interest line. That's just a one-time number.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry, did that answer the question, Sarah, just to check?
Yep.
Great, and then I'll take your third question on government. And so look, I'm not sure I care too much about the impact for people who don't have a MEO fleet, because we do, and it definitely has, it underpins the progress that we're making in government, both with the US government and in global government. But I would say, sort of more broadly, the picture is more positive in the government market in general. And so we also see pickup on our geo fleet, sort of unrelated to O3b, principally in US government. I would say the majority of the growth we're seeing in global government right now comes from MEO and from other institutional programs that we have. And so, you know, I think the broader picture in government is more encouraging than it has been, both with the US and with global governments, sort of now, and the outlook, I think, will remain that way for a while.
Great, thanks.
We'll now take our next question from Nick Dempsey of Barclays. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I've got three left. So first one, just on HD Plus, can I just check that you're saying there was a 6.6 million contribution to growth from HD Plus in Q1, and that will be zero in Q2, or perhaps you weren't being that precise. I just wanted to nail that down. And second question, you're referring to market conditions in international. I wonder if you can give us a bit more color on those. I think we've noted the pay TV subscribers kind of going down in Brazil. I don't know whether Brazil's an issue inside your comments there, or perhaps you can nail that down to the relevant regions. And the third question, so I know you're going to revisit guidance at the first half stage. Can you just give us a bit more color on how that review process is going to work, when it's going to complete, and whether you're still going to give us the same kind of structure of guidance at least?
Great. We're going to deal with the HD Plus question.
Yeah, so on the HD Plus, indeed, the major part of the increase is coming from the price increase. And the ongoing growth, if to come now in Q2, is from additional subscribers coming from drivers like Ultra HD and other features, which we will introduce during the course of the year.
But it'll be, I think it's fair to say, it'll be more modest, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We expect it to be more modest, Nick.
Right.
The second question, and just to repeat that, your question was really when we were referring to a little bit of kind of softness in the international video business, the question was kind of where was that coming from? Is that right, Nick?
Yeah, just get color on why and where.
Yeah, so it's predominantly Africa and Asia. I don't know, Fred, if you want to kind of add. It's not Brazil, was your specific question.
No, it's definitely not Brazil. It is indeed Africa and Asia.
And what this was sort of new, startup businesses that were looking to deploy new distribution neighborhoods that didn't work out in all cases. I don't think that reflects across the industry. And as I've said, we've got some pretty interesting prospects for SES 9 and SES 10. The challenge there is controlling the timing of those. Obviously, the sort of more significant the opportunities, the harder it is for us to control the timing of them. But it really just reflects a little bit of the less strong growth that we expected in the international markets. That's really what we were getting at there, Nick. And then the third question on guidance. There's no mystery to this, right? We've come into the business. We want to make 100% sure that we're across it, that we've drilled the numbers, both as they relate to sort of short-term 2018 and 2020. This is an internal review. It's entirely consistent with what you'd expect. In terms of when will it complete, I would guess sort of May-ish will be done, maybe into June. And will we provide the same sort of guidance going forward? I would think so. I mean, we haven't. As I sit here today, I can't imagine any reason that would cause us to do too much differently. That's kind of what, Andrew, anything to add?
No, I don't think so. I think, as Steve had said, clearly it's what you'd expect us to do, just from a governance and prudence perspective. And I think the review, yes, indeed, we'll be able to share with you at the half-year results is when we'll have everything finished, I think, by that point.
Very good. Next.
We will take our next question from Laurie Davison of Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. It's Laurie here from Deutsche. I understand you can't talk on the 2020 guidance, but could you just help us out with the FY18 guidance? Were the new contract wins that you've highlighted as expected and consistent with that range, or do they point towards sort of the upper end of the range you've given? Second question was that the restructuring charges from the optimization program looked lower than we expected in the quarter. So is there more to come in the second quarter? And can you just update us on what the full year is for the restructuring charges from the optimization program? And then final question, you mentioned the portion of fixed data revenues which are hybrid contracts, i.e. bundled MEO-GEO. Can you just update us? I think that was specifically relating to fixed data. Do you have that type of figure across networks now? Thank you.
Great. So look, on sort of 18 and are the deals that we're signing sort of consistent with our expectations? The answer is yes. I mean, we, in order to meet the guidance, we obviously need to grow the business. And so all of these deals that we're signing are very much orientated around that. Do not read anything into the Q1 results more than the Q1 results is what I'd say. They're a solid set of results. They meet our expectations, and we're happy with that. But I wouldn't encourage you to think about whether that points in this direction or that direction. And that's exactly why we're going to come back to you at the end of the second quarter with an update across the board. With respect to the the sort of internal optimization that we're doing and the charges. Andrew, do you want to just take that?
Yeah, Laurie, as you said, it's 5 million and overall 10 to 12 million. We'll see the balance coming through in Q2 is our plan.
And then in terms of kind of hybrid, and is that exclusively to fixed data? The answer is no. And so we're delivering hybrid networks. And what we mean by that is essentially one customer who has access to both our O3B fleet and our GEO fleet simultaneously, and allowing us to route traffic according to, you know, whatever priority we and or the customer deem appropriate for that service. Sometimes that is availability. Sometimes that is low cost, sometimes that is best performance. And so having that capability to deliver hybrid networks and for those hybrid networks to have a good degree of intelligence in them is a big focus for us, and is quite a differentiator as we see it. And it's something that we do in cruise. It's something that increasingly we're looking at doing in government. So it really does reflect across the whole portfolio of the networks business.
Okay, sorry, just to follow up then. So just on the restructuring charge, the full year, Andrew, are we still on course for the 10 to 15 that you've highlighted before?
Yeah, okay. I think it was 10 to 12, I think. As well.
10 to 12, okay. And sorry, Steve, just to come back on that hybrid networks, you said you're doing in cruise, increasingly in government. So what portion of your business now is done on these hybrid contracts?
So we don't have a number on that per se. I wouldn't say it's not a massive percentage when we look at kind of all of our business across the piece. But I would say it's becoming a differentiator. It's something that we can relatively uniquely offer. Obviously, we're the only business that today operates a broadband non-geostationary network. You know, the idea and the concept of sort of intelligent routing and SD-WAN, this is the same, you know, the same kind of techniques that others are using. What we're able to do is generate a different kind of service and a different kind of offering towards the market by implementing these hybrid networks, and that definitely is a differentiator for us. So in short, I'd say it's not massively significant in terms of our aggregate business across the piece, but I think it's growing in significance in terms of our ability to differentiate from what others can sell.
Understood. All right, thanks.
Thanks, Laurie.
We'll take our next question from Patrick Wellington of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Steve, you were talking about C-band, and I think you said that you're not focused on the financial benefit. And I wondered why you're not focused on the financial benefit. It could be extremely large in the context of SES. Shouldn't one be very focused on the financial benefit?
That's an interesting question, Patrick. It's exactly as I've said, that the mobile industry and the satellite industry have been at war on spectrum for the last I don't know how long. This is the first time where there's a sensible conversation, I believe, that protects the interests of, you know, broadcasters and customers of satellite, provides the opportunity for valuable spectrum towards mobile. And to be clear, we want 5G to be deployed and be successful. We intend to backhaul 5G meaningfully, and so that is in our interests as well. And what I would say is, it's, you know, the costs associated in doing that and the rigor that we have to apply in order to protect our customers is really non-trivial. And so maybe a better characterization is, it's very early days. I think it's way premature to be talking about, you know, the financial benefit to us or frankly to Intelsat, but that's their business. And, you know, I think it's entirely appropriate that our focus is on making sure that if there is a plan, it's an entirely robust plan, and we're not there yet. There's a lot of work to be done there. It's a pretty complex problem. So that is what I would say on that, Patrick.
Okay. I mean, clearly it's quite right that you should protect your customers and your business, but, you know, it is a very big opportunity potentially financially. So presumably you'll be devoting quite a bit of effort to that side of the equation as well. Is that not the case?
So, I'm not sure I can add too much more colour. I think if the proposal that's on the table is not the only proposal, right? There are multiple different views on how C-band can be sort of unlocked, if that's the right way of putting it, for mobile. You know, our focus is making sure that, one, that protects our broadcast customers and satellite in general, is the one that's sort of adopted. And until and unless that's the case, and until we're further through this process, I consider it to be premature to be speculating on sort of any financial value.
Great. Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Sami Kassab of Eklan. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Two questions, please. The video services division has stabilized. Should we expect that trend to continue throughout the year, or would you expect the impact of the contract losses in last year to continue to wait in the second quarter? So perhaps a bit of comment on video services and how you see the trends there. And secondly, on maritime, you're talking about good growth in the cruise segment, but overall stable revenue in maritime. So what is offsetting the growth in cruise, please? Thank you.
Why don't I take the cruise one quickly, and then I'll let Fred take the one on video services. So look, yeah, I mean, in terms of revenue year on year, it was pretty stable. I think what I was referring to and what JP was sort of talking about in terms of the world record that we secured with Carnival and the impact that we've had with them and, you know, a couple of other cruise lines that we're starting to serve now, I think, you know, what we expect is for that business to continue to develop. So, you know, we have a good sense that our offering in cruise is, you know, arguably a market leading one, because we have access to a system that can deliver more capability and at better performance, i.e. lower latency, than any other system. And when we combine that with our geo fleet, our geo capability, it's really compelling, and that is resonating in the market. So we feel optimistic about the cruise market more broadly. And you know, I would hope that we will have some good news to share with you on that over the course of the next couple of quarters.
And regarding the video services activities of MixOne, it's basically the return to stability and stable business throughout the year, but being understood that this is of the exception of the impact of IRS 15, so the accounting change, which had a negative impact this year of 8.2 million.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Michael Bishop of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. It's just a follow-up on the C-band debate. It seems like you're saying that there's various proposals on the table, so I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that and also give us your best indication of what you think the prospective timelines look like with the various options. Thanks very much.
Yeah, so look, the FCC are going to go through an NPRM and a rulemaking process. We're obviously, you know, can't comment too much on the timing of that, because obviously that's a question for the FCC. I think they are motivated to move on this relatively quickly. I think we'll see some activity in the second half of the year with respect to the FCC. And yeah, as you'd expect, there are multiple proposals. I think they're all out in the public domain. I think it's fair to say that this sort of market-based approach is one that is being well considered and favorably considered, and we're happy with that. We're doing a ton of work on it, again, framed around our networks, our customers' networks, making sure we understand what we would have to do in order to free up some of this C-band. And, you know, so yeah, it's early. There are multiple proposals. I think this market-based one that ourselves and Intelsat and Intel are pursuing is well thought of. I think it's the only one that really balances the various different stakeholders in the equation. But the FCC are ultimately the ones who are going to make that call, not us. And so we obviously have to go through that FCC process.
Thanks. And maybe just to follow up in terms of the costs of essentially the Intelsat process, do you have any early indication of whether that's a difficult process or whether that's a fairly simple process? Because clearly there's a slight difference in terms of what the FCC has in terms of the amount of spectrum freed up versus the Intelsat plan. Thanks.
Yeah, so and again, that kind of reflects the ongoing discussion and the fact that there's still a long way to go. The challenge gets increasingly hard the more bandwidth you're looking to free, is the obvious point. This potentially requires us to invest meaningfully in the ground segment associated with the cable neighborhoods, potentially meaningfully in new satellites to offset the fact that there's less spectrum available on each one. And so depending on where you sort of draw that line and depending on how much spectrum you try and free, you know, that dictates fairly meaningfully the cost and complexity that's sort of driven into the satellite networks. And all of that work is ongoing at present.
Hey, thanks very much.
We'll take our next question from Wilson Fry of RBC. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Congratulations on the quarter. Good to see SES starting to turn the corner. I guess in the spirit of rebuilding trust, please could you give us some details on any financial covenants you may have in the loans? I'm particularly interested in the 2009 export credit facility, the one guaranteed by COFAS. I'm assuming there are tightening covenants in that that haven't been disclosed because they're private. Thanks.
On the covenants, actually, we don't really have any financial covenants per se in our loan agreements. We have our internal target that we set for leverage of 3.3 times, and that's the discussions we have ongoing with the rating agencies. And as you've seen, as I went through, Q1 is 3.41 times, which is pretty well in line with what the plans have been, and that reflects about 60% of the total for CapEx and interest payments for the full year. And in fact, there was another element as well that we were expecting about 60 million of withholding tax refund coming back from Brazil at the end of March that actually came in April, and that itself was about 4 basis points. So in summary, we expect to be below 3.3 times at the year end.
But to be clear, there aren't any covenants in those old loans?
No.
Thanks.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Alexander Peter of Societe Generale. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I'd just like to hear a little bit more in networks about the capacity expansion that's coming through. Could you help us understand how we should model the additional capacity from the O3b constellation expansion here? And I know you've given some indication on that when O3b was acquired, but that was a while ago, and I was wondering whether that's changed over time and how you'd guide us today on this, also how to distribute this revenue among the networks divisions. And then secondly, on financing, you have substantial debt refinancing coming through in the next 5 years with quite some regularity, and it's good to see you raising 500 million with an 8-year duration on a very reasonable coupon, so that's good. But in the context of a strong likelihood of rising interest rates, do you have any way to lock in the current low financing costs for future debt rollover operations? Thank you.
Okay, so why don't I take a shot on the kind of the O3b new capacity from a modelling standpoint, and I'll kind of look to the team also to help me out here. So, look, the first thing I'd say is, The four new satellites are going to come into service in the second half of the year. So we expect sort of June, July, we will have those satellites sort of fully you know, into the constellation. And obviously, as we bring new satellites in, it's not an immediate sort of uptick in revenue in quite the same way that SES 15 was. So we're going to see a more gradual ramping into that capacity, although certainly there are some regions where we've got some pent-up demand, and JP will talk a little bit about kind of the regions and the verticals that we would see benefiting from that. What I would say is, you know, obviously that's fully anticipated in our, you know, in our projections for 2018. So we very much need these satellites, and the revenues that are going to start to flow from these satellites are kind of the ones that we expect in the second half of the year. We're very happy, obviously, that the launch went well and that, you know, the plan to integrate them into the constellation is well underway. JB, do you want to just say a few words about kind of the verticals and how we see that capacity being taken up?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And certainly that capacity is keenly awaited in certain of the segments. So if I touch on maybe two or three of those, certainly in our continued maritime growth, which is really around the Caribbean and North American markets and Europe. We're looking to augment the capacity to reflect the ongoing success we have in that particular market. So more capacity going into that segment. If you look at fixed data, then again, pent-up demand we're seeing certainly in Asia and some parts of Africa that, again, will be something we'll be keenly adding that capacity to. And certainly in government as well, also across Africa and the Middle East, is somewhere we'll be keenly looking forward to leverage that additional capacity. So they're probably the three segments I'll touch on most of all, Steve.
Yep.
And in terms of the leverage, yes, indeed, I appreciate your comments that the Treasury Group will be very active in getting that replacement for the bond that was coming up in Q4, and the coupon rate was, as I say, the best the company has accomplished, so the guys have done a great job there. I can say overall, when you look at our debt, about 96% of our debt is actually fixed, and in fact, with the bond we just done, the average interest rate has come down slightly across the group. So the next sort of refinancing is in March of 2019, and obviously we're very proactive and we'll be looking at that in the full course of time as to the best way to finance that. It's probably the best I could say.
Thank you very much.
We'll now take our final question from Giles Thorne of Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hi, morning everyone. I had three questions. The first one was on mobility, and now that your largest mobility partner is recapitalized and new management in place, are you seeing any step change in commercial discussions coming out of Global Eagle? And actually, have you had any frustrations over the past couple of years while GEE has been dealing with its various problems? And then my second two questions, no apologies for turning the conversation back to C-band, but it is a material and near-term event. My first question is, with advances in compression and modulation, how much of the 500 megahertz C-band assignment do you actually need to sustain the current cable head-end business? And then secondly, there's a large question mark out there as to exactly who owns the spectrum, certainly in the case of Intelsat, where because it was an IGO and it's now held by ITSO, and there's some idiosyncrasies there. In your case, if I remember correctly, you got into cable head-end distribution via your GE Americom acquisition. So is there any similar idiosyncrasy as to who actually has the economic rights over that spectrum in your case? Those are my two questions. Thanks.
Okay. So on mobility and Global Eagle, look, I mean, Global Eagle has been very transparent with us all the way through their process. And we've seen nothing but, you know, good partnership and great growth from Global Eagle, frankly, over the course of the last, you know, couple of years. And so while obviously they were sort of restructuring their business in what is obviously a very capitally intensive period for all of the aeronautical service providers, they've been nothing but a great partner, and we're more than, you know, very, very happy to be supporting their growth, and they are now a very important customer for us on SES 15. And look, on the C-band, how much do we need? The honest answer to that is right now and today, all of it, right? It's not a well-known fact, but we are full in our video neighborhoods in North America, and so there is 0 megahertz available, you know, for any other application or any other uses as of right now and today, which kind of underscores the point that in order to, you know, free up bandwidth for the mobile industry, we have to do some fairly meaningful things, and those meaningful things are sort of non-trivial. And so, Giles, you characterized it as relatively short term. I really don't see it that way. I think this is a process that is technically challenging, that will take time, that I'm optimistic about, but it really requires a significant amount of sort of investment and change within the operation of the cable neighborhoods in order to sort of facilitate this plan. And I think that's probably, it's an important part of the discussions that we're having, making sure that is well characterized. And obviously, the more aggressive or the more bandwidth that is under consideration, the more challenging those plans become. And so each incremental megahertz becomes harder and harder to deliver. So it's it is going to be a long-term process. There is some, fair amount of uncertainty associated with it. And with respect to who has the quote-unquote right to the spectrum, we don't really look at it that way at all. What we look at it as, these are the necessary things that would have to happen in order for this plan to tick the boxes for all stakeholders. And that's really the basis of the conversation. And that's, in my view, that's the only way that this is going to work. That's why I consider this to be a win-win potential outcome, whereas every single other one has always been win-lose. Somebody loses as a result of any previous kind of discussion around how to free up bandwidth for the mobile industry. So it's long term, it's complicated, we're working it hard, I'm optimistic, but it's early days.
Very good. And if I may just squeeze in one last follow up, could you give any color into the nature of the framework you have with Intelsat around the division of any type of economic windfall that goes through that consortium? Presumably you're going to say no, but I thought I'd ask.
You're exactly right, Giles.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you. All right.
Fair enough.
Operator, thanks everyone. That concludes the presentation. As always, feel free to reach out to myself or the rest of the IR team should you have any follow-ups. Have a good day and a great weekend.
Thanks,
Thank
everyone.
You.
Thank you.